So I think, as many of us know, today is Mother's Day, which is, you know, unique in the sense that there is not one human being or animal alive doesn't have a mother. So it is one of those experiences that is common to all of us. So I want to kind of talk about that. I want to talk, you know, in our intensive and over past weeks, we've been spending a lot of time talking about developing a true loving, kind, and compassionate heart, especially as we see in our world so much of the opposite of that, which is being shared. And traditionally, you know, in Buddhism, our way is the way of love and understanding. That is how we enter the world. So I want to talk a little bit about that. And then Betsy's retreat this weekend is on the inner critic. I think there are about 35, 40 people involved in that retreat. And so I think they all, like everything else, everything interpenetrates. So but first, let me start with Mother's Day. So for decades now, whenever Mother's Day comes, I always reach for this book. It's called A Flower for You. It was retitled A Flower for Your Coat. Does that sound right? Or a rose for your coat? What? Your lapel or your pocket or something. So this is from the early 90s, and I opened it up. And in August of 92, I gave this one to my mother. And I said, gifts or cards could not express better my thoughts, feelings, and good wishes for your birthday than this little book. May you live to be 100. And wishes do come true, because my mother lived to be 102. So that shows you. It's good to make good wishes. I won't read from this other than to say it's quite wonderful and quite personal. Thich Nhat Hanh was not just a great Zen master and teacher. He was also somebody who was willing to share his heart and his vulnerability. And he wrote this originally. I'm not sure if he wrote it in Japan or around that time, because he had this experience where he was in town, studying. And he was approached by some students who whispered to whoever he was with who spoke Japanese. He didn't speak any Japanese. They whispered to whoever was accompanying him who could speak both languages. And then they were handing out little roses. And they put a white rose on his brown jacket. And afterwards, he asked whoever he was hosting him what that meant. And they said, well, in Japan, today is Mother's Day. And traditionally, people go around, and if your mother is alive, they give you a red rose. And if your mother is dead, they give you a white rose. And Thich Nhat Hanh said he was sort of devastated. Because his mother had died many, many years ago. And he realized he was an orphan. And so he wrote this really beautiful book about the preciousness of mothers, especially for those who still have a mother alive. And it's quite beautiful, because traditionally, the mother has been the archetype, right, of, you know, selflessness, endless giving, love, compassion, you know, the fountain of all goodness, right? And we have been nurtured by that. So traditionally it said, we have learned, if we've learned anything, we've learned of all these good traits, again, like love and kindness and compassion and selflessness and all that, from our mothers. So traditionally, mothers were very sacred and instrumental in having a reference point. A reference point for how to be with everyone. So it was sort of like, this is the living experience, the living model that everyone has. And in Buddhism, the idea was, to be that way with everyone. And in the Bodhisattva literature, they talk about, all motherly sentient beings. They talk about, sentient beings are sentient beings, humans, animals, sentient beings. But they talk about motherly sentient beings. All beings have been your mother. Or they talk about bodhisattvas see all beings as their children, right? Just like you're the mother and they're your children. So that's the archetype and that's the traditional experience. So how does that relate to Betsy's retreat this weekend on the inner critic? I've probably said this before and on other Mother's Day talk, but for many of our Asian teachers who have shared these teachings with us, they have been quite surprised. I would say quite shocked that there are many Americans who do not hold their mother as the archetype of selfless love. So when they would kind of be using these traditional examples, again, they were kind of dumbfounded to see that for many people, that was not their experience. And so this traditional thing did not work. And of course, that relates to the inner critic. But I think even for those of us who might not have had the most selfless, loving, compassionate mother, we can still gather much from her. And again, we want to learn to focus on the wholesome and not the unwholesome. We want to focus on what we received rather than what we missed. That creates a much better mind state and allows us to understand things more deeply. So we would not be here. I mean, this is the, if there's any great gift our mother and our father gave us is what? Life. And without life, we would not be here. We would not have a body. I mean, if you could imagine living your life without a body, it would have been quite difficult. We wouldn't have had a life. So having a life, having a body, is only because of our mother and our father. So that is one gift, great gift, that has been given to all of us. And also, whatever the quality of our mother, because of her own sufferings, she did put up with often the uncomfortable experience for 9 months of having a child within her, right? And that's often uncomfortable, painful, difficult, and yet she did it. And we know that the birth process can be very difficult and painful and long for many mothers, and yet our mother went through this. And no matter what the quality of her capacity to love, I would imagine for pretty much all of us, we are only alive because in those early days, our mothers took care of us. They made sure we were fed, we were changed. When we were cold, and they perhaps wrapped us in blankets. When we were hot, they did things to cool us. So again, we did receive our life and certain kinds of nourishment from our mother. And that's very important to realize, you know, a lot of who we are as human beings originally begins with this sense of trust. Very important, sense of trust. That the simplicity of our needs when we're infants are being met, you see. So unconsciously, the child is learning about whether the world is there to meet their needs, to respond to them, right, at a very prime level. Right? And if we did have more than that, it's okay, it's okay, it's okay, it's okay. Our mothers taught us to be forgiving. Right? Because we as children weren't always wonderful, were we? Anybody think they were always wonderful? No, oftentimes we were difficult, we were sick, we were cranky, you know, we acted out when our needs weren't being met, and our mother made sure that we got fed and changed and all that good stuff. So our mother taught us many things in our life. So again, if we were fortunate, we had a mother who really was able to touch us with love and caring and acceptance and nurturance and support, and, right? All those good qualities. And that early nurturance unconsciously has given us the ability to know those qualities in life. And I guess what I'm suggesting is, Unless it really was a very extreme situation, most of us, even if we don't remember, but if we reflect in this way, can realize there are many gifts that we have received from our mother. And in the teachings it says, to not reflect on that is to be no different than an animal. This is nothing negative against animals, but most animals, mammals or whatever, and other types of animals, you know, after the birth process is done, and after whatever little basic nurturance it is, you know, they split, right? You know, they go off. The bird flies away, the animal goes out into the woods, you know? I mean, it's an ongoing process. But we, as human beings who are very conscious and aware and can reflect on these gifts, we have this great ability to touch deep within ourselves this wonderful capacity that we learned early on about nurturance and selflessness. And even though we may think, ooh, my mother was not a selfless person, you know, or kind of selfish or whatever. But if we think back to those early days, which we can't remember, right, we know that there had to be all kinds of sacrifices that our mother made. You know, we were up all night. We had to be fed every 4 hours. We, you know, all that kind of stuff. We would be sick. And our mothers were there for us. So it's very important, no matter what happened afterwards, that we touch into this aspect of what has formed us as human beings. Unfortunately, in our culture, particularly our American society, for many, many reasons, people don't grow up consistently nurtured by love and compassion and understanding and patience, right? And oftentimes, in spite of themselves, growing up in our family can be painful. In the Dharma, we talk about, you know, that everyone has seeds, wholesome seeds, unwholesome seeds. If wholesome seeds are cultivated, wholesome qualities grow. If unwholesome seeds are cultivated, unwholesome qualities go. It's really as simple as that. And for many of us, because our parents, our mother, let's say, in this case, had not had her wholesome seeds, her seeds of love and understanding and patience and caring, watered, or not significantly watered, her capacity to water those in us were limited, or inconsistent, or intermittent. And that's sort of what has conditioned us. And so we come to, you know, this retreat that Betsy's offering, and we've offered workshops and we will continue to, because this inner critic is the result of what I'm talking about. You know, that when we grow up in an environment where we are not met with love and acceptance and understanding and support, you know, and the messages come in very different ways. Sometimes the messages come in words, sometimes the messages come in actions, or lack of words, or lack of actions. But in many ways, children growing up and again, they're children. Again, we are children when we are young, which means what? We are very undeveloped. Our minds, our brains are very undeveloped. Our experience is very short term. And we're children, you know. We don't know a lot. So we grow up in those environments without understanding what's really going on. We make a fundamental mistake, which is we think that the problem is who? The reason I'm not being loved, the reason I'm being criticized, the reason I'm being abused, the reason I'm not being, we think it's because of what? Because of me, you see. That's the fundamental problem. We don't have the understanding that we maybe have now, which is, you know, my poor mother has suffered greatly in this life. You know, she grew up perhaps without love, or she grew up in very difficult situations, you know. We don't, children don't think that way, do they? They don't have understanding. So we tend to blame ourselves. There must be something wrong in me. That's why I'm, that's why I'm not being loved. That's why I'm being nurtured. And especially if you hear critical comments from your parents about you, you think they're real. You think they're true because they're your parents, you see. And so what happens is the child internalizes the voice, right? Internalize the voice. And as years go by, as decades go by, we forget that we weren't born this way, you see. Nobody was born with an inner critic, right? It's impossible because nobody is born with language, you know. And as I've often said, you know, the proof of that, if you've ever been around young children, I mean, infants, is what? They can have a poopy diaper and it's, you know, it doesn't bother them other than it's uncomfortable. I mean, they're not embarrassed. They don't think there's something wrong with them. They're not ashamed of themselves, right? They're just, that's just what it is, you see. So that shows you we have this incredible natural capacity just to be what, with what is, without judgment. But over time, we, as this other way of, this other voice gets louder and louder, we forget who we really are. We forget our original mind, our original nature, our original state of being that we all came in with. And over time, this inner voice, this inner narrative, this inner construction of self that we've each of us have created, which has our name, right? That inner voice that only we hear, right? We think is what? Is speaking the truth, right? And, you know, to have that inner voice, for some it's a very loud, consistent voice, for some it's soft, for some it's just episodic, you know, most of the time it's okay, but certain situations you hear that voice. And we identify with it. We identify with it. And we do that to our own detriment, to our own suffering. We think it's speaking the truth, you see. And the problem is, even as we, you know, read the books and as we hear the talks, we begin to understand, oh, it's really not who I am, it's really my inner critic, it's really, you know what I'm saying? We learn all these things. The problem is, it still happens, you see. It still happens. Because we learned this before this got really developed, you see. And so it sits here, you see. And a lot of our adult learning is up here. And if we don't understand that, that there's got to be a transmission more deeply into the depths of our heart-mind, you know, so the healing and the transforming can occur. You know, that's really, you know, the essence of our path, you see. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh wrote a book on Yogacara called Transformation at the Base. It's not called that anymore. I think it's called Understanding Your Mind now or something, but it, you know, I think his original title was much more accurate. In this deeper aspect of our mind, in the mind of our conditioning, in the mind of our past, in Buddhism that's called the Alaya Vijnana, the storehouse consciousness. You know, this is where the seeds of the past conditioning lie. And if we're only working up here, right, reading the books, going to the talks, you see, it won't get down here. Transformation, healing has to happen in the base of our minds. So what if we didn't have a good mother? You might want to reflect for a moment. You don't need to say anything, just reflect. In your heart, do you feel like you had a good mother? And like over here is a good mother, like with capital G, capital M. Over on this side is bad mother, capital B, capital M. And, you know, so somewhere on there. And again, it doesn't mean it's true, but it means, how have I internalized within myself, you know, mother? So just close your eyes a second. Just ask yourself, you know. Again, just be honest. No one's going to ask you anything. When I think of mother, my mother, mother, is it over here on the good mother, capital G, capital M? Is it really been the down here with the capital B, capital M, bad mother? Or is it somewhere in the middle? So the good news is, it really doesn't matter anymore. It may have mattered in the past that we were conditioned in this way, and it's left its residue within our minds and our hearts. But the good news is, it doesn't matter anymore. Why doesn't it matter? Because the essence of the Buddhist path is that nothing is solid, nothing is permanent. You know, that actually life, minds are a very wide open field. And no matter what has happened to us in the past, no matter what has conditioned us, each of us has the capacity to heal and transform, right? That's the, in a nutshell, that's the kind of essence of our faith and trust in this path. So for those of us who are on the good mother side of life and had a good mother, as a good example of what it means to be a loving, selfless, caring, compassionate, friendly, loyal, supportive human being, right? We have a model, right? For those of us who had some of that, perhaps intermittently or episodically or at certain times, we also have had the experience of that. And when I say we've had the experience, it means we know what that feels like, right? We know when it, what that feels like, when somebody that we care about, or, you know, is a powerful figure in our life, even for a moment, we know they care about us. We know they would like us to be happy and not to suffer, right? That they want to support us in having a decent life, you see. But let's say we're really down the other side and we kind of don't even remember that, you know? We had a mother, father, who suffered greatly, who never received that in their growing up. It's not like, again, nothing's solid in Buddhism. There's no solid people. There's no solid person. People are just made up of thoughts and feelings and perceptions and their own storehouse consciousness. There's nothing solid in any of this. But we saw the manifestation of that in our parents. So if we've had a good model, then we have a kind of an experiential way of working and being in the world. But if we don't have a good model, we can what? Something we've all done. We find a good model, right? I mean, many of us, I mean, you think about, we start out as children. If you have some kind of work professional skill, right? I imagine pretty much everybody here, at this point in their life has some sort of work professional skill, capacities. We didn't have those as infants, did we? We didn't have those when we were 3 years old or 5 year old or 9 year old, right? How did we become competent at what we've become competent at? Anybody have any brainstorm? Yeah, we had examples. We learned, right? And that's very important to understand that we can learn. And we can learn it by finding mentors who will, be an example of, but also teach us how to be a loving, caring, compassionate, selfless human being. Even if we take an inventory and we say, gee, I am the most selfish, self-centered, uncaring person in the world, right? My response would be, that's great. That's who you've been. Who do you want to be? And in that, who do you want to be? How do you want to be in this world? This gets in touch with your aspiration, not your conditioning, right? What our conditioning was, what our family of origin, what's happened to us already in this life, we can't change any of that, can we? But we can have something awakening in us that shows us there is another way to live, that I want to learn how to be, right? And if that becomes a strong aspiration in us, then again, finding the technology, forgive the word, that will help us do it. Finding the teachers, finding the mentors, finding the examples, finding good friends, all those things that help speed along and nurture, our change is possible for all of us. So let me just stop a second and just ask you, do you believe that? Just close your eyes in the hall at home. Do you believe that? This is like having a very personal, honest, we hear the words, we know the teachings, but the asking myself, do I really believe this is possible for me? The way I've been, when I look into my mind, the things I hear that's going on in there, right? It may not be always the most wholesome. Do I believe that I have the possibility to heal my wounds and transform all the unwholesome in me into wholesomeness? Just ask yourself that question. Close your eyes. Ask yourself, do I really believe that? And interesting, listen to what you hear as the response that comes up deep inside you. What do you hear? Do you hear a resounding 100% buy-in? Or not? Do you hear trust or mistrust? Or do you hear a voice saying, not for you? You're too this. You're too wounded. You're too damaged. You're too... By the way, that's the voice of the inner critic, if you're wanting to hear what it sounds like. Like, who is that? Do you ever ask yourself, who is it down there that talks this way? It's an interesting meditation question. Whose voice is that? Where does it come from? Shantideva, the great Buddhist master of 8th century India said, you know, swords can hurt you, bludgeons can hurt you, right? Because they're, you know, solid things, you know, they can really hurt. But he says, thoughts, they don't have any weapons. How can they hurt you? Very interesting question. How do they hurt me? They're just thoughts. When you look in your mind at these thoughts, these inner critic thoughts, thoughts that are critical of you, do they have any weapons to hurt you? How do they hurt you? Do they have any form, any shape, any solidity? When you hear these voices inside you, if you look for their source, where they're coming from, what do you find? Can you find anything? Or is it just a disembodied voice? That only I can hear, resounding in the echo chamber of my own mind and has no reality at all. Could that be? So if we have grown up without a loving, compassionate mother or father, if we received lots of negative messages, harmful messages that we've internalized, the good news is each of us can heal that part of us. Each of us can become that person that we might not have had as a child for ourselves. We can become that loving, selfless, supportive, caring, person in our life. We don't have to go back into the past. We don't even need another person to do it. We can heal ourselves. Doesn't mean, you know, it's not good to get some help along the way. Yeah. when we take responsibility for ourselves, we take responsibility, you know, we take responsibility for our physical wounds, right? Go to the drugstore and get some stuff. We go to the doctor and get some stuff. I mean, we, you know, when we are sick, when we're physically wounded, you know, we go to the hospital, we go to the ER. I mean, we take care of our physical wounds, right? And yet our emotional wounds, we let them fester year after year, decade after decade. We don't have to. And if we find those qualities within ourselves to heal those parts within us that are wounded, we are becoming a different person through that process. We are becoming the father and mother that we always wanted. We don't have to be dependent on anyone else. But it takes a big shift, and it takes, you know, a real willingness to take full responsibility. Stop blaming, stop holding others responsible. You know, we understand causes and conditions has led us, but in this moment, That way of thinking is just not productive, you see. It takes us down a blind alley. If what we want is healing and transformation, we want an open heart, we want a loving heart, we want a kind heart, we want to learn to be able to be there for others, right? Which I think most of us want. Again, we have that capacity. And within the Buddhist tradition, you know, there are lots of practices to help us develop loving kindness toward ourselves, toward others, to help us learn how to be a compassionate person, how to generate compassion, how to cultivate compassion for ourselves and others. So if we go, gee, if I'm honest, I really don't know how to do that. Well, then it's just a matter of learning, right? Like anything else. Something I got to learn. Right? Like, anybody find, when they sit down to meditation, their concentration is like unstoppable, right? Is that everybody's experience? You know, just sit down and 100% concentrated, instant calmness, peace, great radiance, is that? We know we have to what? We have to train our mind. In concentration and mindfulness. In the same way, we have to train our mind in compassion and loving kindness. And the problem today is if we're attentive to the societal messages of our society and culture, this is not what people are talking about, is it? No. People are not talking about love and understanding. People are talking about what? Anger, hatred, fear, separation, differences. So the message is that so much is going on in our society at all levels is not a message that cultivates this loving heart. This heart that sees all human beings want to be happy and don't want to suffer. I mean, right now we have, everyone's very attentive to the war in Ukraine, you know, and depending on where you line up, there are good people and bad people, right? I mean, that's the way we do it. But if you kind of step up a little bigger, you go, what? Every soldier has or had a mother who wants them to be alive. I mean, that's the truth. You know, that in that war, in that suffering, everyone is suffering. No mother wants to lose their child, right? No child wants to lose their mother. See, that's where we're the same. But if we don't stop and recognize, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh said about the war in Vietnam, he said, you know, brothers are killing brothers. They don't see that they're all part of the same family. Right. You know, so it's a very difficult time, you know, in our society to to have an open heart that embraces everyone, that cares about the suffering of everyone. The war in Ukraine, everybody's suffering, right? Soldiers on both sides are suffering great fear and anger and hurt and loss. Civilians are you know, facing that, experiencing that. So it's very important that we touch the suffering of this world. That's what the Buddha taught us. You know, there is suffering in this world. I mean, there's pleasure and there's gain and loss and all that, but in all of it, there is this suffering that human beings create for each other, that we create for ourselves, that parents unknowingly create for their children. Thich Nhat Hanh in this book, he says it still pains him, you know. I mean, he became a monk, right? And he said, you know, I'm very happy with my choice, but it pains me to know that when I left my mother to become a monk, it caused her suffering. And he talked about his sister, and I guess in the Vietnamese culture, you sort of left your family and then sort of, you know, more united with your husband's family. So, you know, so his sister also left her mother. And he said, you know, he understands, you know, from a societal point of view, that's what happens. But he says, I still bear a kind of sadness knowing that I caused my mother pain. Yeah, so today's Mother's Day. It's important, you know, at the same time we're doing the brunches and making the calls, if we still have a mother or you have somebody to call you mother, you know, all those good things. But I think it's also good that we take this time to reflect on this deeper meaning, some of the things we touched on today. So we could make good use of these Mother's Days. So let me stop here and let me open the floor. Anybody want to comment or question? And people online, if they want to, they can tell Scott they want to say something. So sort of just stop a minute, what's in your heart? Any questions or just what's in your heart? Yes, Jose. Maria, thank you. So in the hall, Jose.
Thank you, Fred, for that talk. When we were discussing that everybody has the potential to learn and change and even if we don't have the role model, we can learn all that. I'm assuming that you need to access your base before that.
You have to access your what?
Your base. We were talking about that base that you had in you. And so if that's the case, how do you access that base? That's probably like a different Dharma talk, but I'm curious about that.
Yeah, so how do you access that base? That base that needs to be transformed. Okay. So again, it's all one mind. So when we talk about upper levels of the mind, deeper levels of the mind, we're just really making a classification that's really, they're not different places. It's all right here. Okay. So again, you know, it's this, we start at the surface, you know, the things we're aware of. So this is mindfulness, right? So Jose is practicing mindfulness. You know, and he's practicing mindfulness of his body, of his mind, of his emotions, of his thoughts. These are the areas, you know, that we practice mindfulness. As we practice and become more aware, we notice things. And usually we notice things, you know, surfacely. We notice certain kinds of mind states, certain kind of thoughts that seem to come up by themselves and take us over, right? Certain kind of memories, certain kind of feeling states. You see, we notice if we're mindful, right? And we notice that some are wholesome and some are not wholesome. Some are conducive to supporting our happiness and our well-being, and some sabotage that. Okay, that's our mindfulness. So, you know, in the beginning, where our mindfulness just kind of reveals topography of what's going on inside Jose. All right, you know, and so he realizes, you know, I'm not just a conscious person, you know, things are happening unconsciously, things are just arising in my mind. I mean, you know, thoughts just arise, feeling states just arise. I mean, they arise without us cultivating them or calling them up. They just arise. You know, where are they coming from? They're coming from the base. So you kind of get to know yourself better, you get the topography, and you realize something's going on down there. Because consciously, I'd like to be this way and this way, this way, and I get up in the morning and I set my intentions for the day, and you know what I mean, and how I want to be, and you know, there it is again, right? Right? And rather than getting frustrated with yourself, or you realize, oh, the problem is at the base, in the deeper parts of my mind. You know, so we experience things at the surface, the feeling states, the mind states, the thoughts, but they're coming from a deeper place. And so it's through our meditation practice and deep looking that we begin to find those places. You know, I mean, some of it is what we talked about today is historical, right? Oh, now, yeah, where did this mind state come from? You know, where did this kind of reaction come from? Right? Well, you begin to kind of, you know, everything in Buddhism is cause and effect. It has to come from somewhere, you know. So you look in your own causes, in your own life, and you'll see, like the inner critic, you know. I mean, people hear that voice and they think it's their voice, but if they look deeply, they'll see, oh, I remember as a child, you know, there were all these messages that I was receiving, right? Which I internalized. Oh, that's where it comes from, you know. So that's a kind of one way of looking at it. Yeah, so the other thing is you become very attentive to your mind. And, you know, this is the inner healing piece. So you realize, I was just talking to somebody the other day, You know, this is a person, very rational, mature, you know, functions in life quite well. And yet they're very frustrated because they get into these mind states, which are like the mind state of an adolescent, the mind state of a child. And the feelings and the agitation is just like that. You know, and what I had to point out with them, well, I understand that you are, you know, you've matured and you're grown up and all that, but there's a part of you that's still 11 years old. You know? And it's like, I mean, I use the example, a lot of times it's like, you know, there's a car, it's only got one driving wheel, but there are like two people fighting, right, for the wheel. Who's gonna run my life? Or who's gonna respond to this situation? You see? Is it gonna be the mature, wise, compassionate, understanding Jose? Or is it gonna be that, you know who I'm talking about? And sometimes, you know, it's like a fight. You know. So we want to understand that. And we want to embrace, you see. That's what I was trying to say earlier. It's like, it's not personal. You just realize there's just this part of me that's kind of frozen in time and still sees life like an 11-year-old, right? I mean, very competent people still have lots of anxiety in certain kind of social or work situations. Why is that? You know, you've been doing it for 20 years. I mean, you're because there's somebody else in there, right? You see? And that's where the healing is. You know, we stop and we bring that one into ourselves. It's not like out there. We bring it in. Oh. And we ask ourselves, what does this part of myself need? What has it got to hear that it didn't hear when I was growing up? See, I can do that now, right? I can be the loving mother. I can be the loving father right now for myself. And it sounds a little hokey for some people. It sounds something, oh, that's pretty hokey. Yeah, it is hokey. It's hard for us to admit, you see, that there's parts of us that are just kind of like stuck in time. Some people are stuck in time like being a 5-year-old or an 8-year-old or 11-year-old or, you know, a 15-year-old. You know, we still find that we respond to life or situations in that way. It's because those parts are in our storehouse. Does that give you a sense of? Anybody else with a comment or question? Oh, wait, let me just take Scott. Yeah, so in Buddhist psychology, Abhidhamma, they're all listed. There are 50-something, and the wholesome and unwholesome. But yeah, so but the question is really, now the early criteria of the Buddhist meditators who put this whole system together, you know, 2,000 years ago, their criteria was, because they were meditators, so their criteria was wholesome, which is whatever supported a calm, clear mind. That was wholesome. That was a wholesome mind state. Anything that disturbed that or agitated or, you know, or made it difficult to meditate was unwholesome, right? And then from that they extrapolated, yeah, that a mind of love, a mind of happiness, a mind of compassion is a peaceful mind, right? A mind of anger, a mind of fear, a mind of despair, right, is an unwholesome mind because it disturbs you, right? If you can just stop a bit and go, let me remember what it's like to be angry, and let me remember what it's like to be really caring about someone, they feel differently, don't they? Right? Not just in terms of the action, but just as a feeling state, right? When we're angry, when we're irritated, we're what? We're agitated, some degree. You know, when we're anxious, when we're worried, our mind's agitated. But when we're, you know, with somebody and we're caring and we're open and we're, right, our mind is more settled, you see. So that's the criteria. Wholesome and unwholesome. It's in relation to that. It's not really based on morals or ethics, which are also important. It's really based on the mind state. You know, wholesome qualities, mind states are one that support creating a calm, open, spacious mind. Anything that sabotages that is an afflictive mind state. And last but not least, Angie.
I'd like to say happy Mother's Day to all the mothers. I was just until an hour ago, I was participating in Betsy's retreat, which was wonderful. And it was interesting because there were many mothers in the retreat. And when people were asked initially about, you know, what does your inner critic say? A lot of it had to do with, I'm not a good mother. I'm impatient. Some were small children, some were grown. So I realized, you know, it's not just our mothers, but the way we mother, we tend to focus on, I think, what we don't do right. And we saw one film where they interviewed a bunch of mothers about, you know, what kind of a mother are you? And everyone was just so negative. They were all focusing on, I don't spend enough time, I'm impatient, I don't tell them I love them enough. And then they interviewed the children. And the children were like, I have the best mother in the world. She listens to me all the time. It really made us all cry. It was so sweet. And it just, I guess what struck me is that we also, Betsy, talked a lot about judging in a negative way versus discernment. And so, yes, I know being a mother myself that I could be more patient. I could, I mean, there's always things we can look at to do, and it's not too late to start, as I found, you know, with my son, as we do things that are unskillful to stop, you know, so it doesn't have to be that negative inner critic. But that transformation that you're talking about at the base can also happen in those relationships with our children and our friends now. And anyway, it was just a beautiful experience, and thank you for filling it out more in your talk this morning.
Good. So thank you, everyone, for listening. I want to give a special greeting to Ernestine, who I see, a long-term student Dharma teacher of Thich Nhat Hanh. So happy to help. Your causing conditions have brought you to the barbarian state of Florida. Thank you, everyone.